Welcome to episode 96 of the Dipshit Files. Holy fuck. I'm Mr. Scriptkeeper.
And I'm Mrs. Scriptkeeper.
And today it's true crime.
Yes, it is.
And it's a bunch of stories, right?
Yeah, well, I've got a whole collection of cold cases that were solved recently. So they were solved sometime between like the last quarter of 2003.
23.
To current.
This is new shit.
24. They're newly solved cases.
Well,
yeah.
Fuck me. Let's open the file of new shit. We're basically the news now. All right, before we get to the dipshit files, let's talk about the Battlescat card.
Card.
Yeah, it's the Metal Battlescat Challenge card. You can get that $39.99 and get your name engraved on the front. It's going to be a tight card. There's also the Ultra Battlescat set, which has a whole bunch of extra cards in it. You can get your name listed on the back of one of those as well if you buy that. $79.99. Thank you guys for already getting on there. Make sure if you order it, you put your name in the order form on the website, scatcast.com. All right, let's get into the show.
The Dipshit Files presents Solve Cold Cases Compilation Thing. I don't know.
All right, so this week we have six true crime stories.
We do, yes.
And then they've all were solved within the last
6 months or so.
Shit.
There's a few of them, as you listen to these stories, you'll see there are a few of them where the suspects were glaring, but they had an issue either getting to them or... there's one that they know who did it, but there was no trial or anything like that because the people have died.
Oh, they shot
that
him
sort
into
of thing.
The sun from a cannon.
They shot him.
Good.
Yes, and there are six of these stories. I found each one of these interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them have a really interesting twist as to how they were solved. So it's fascinating, but none of these stories can stand alone on their own for a full episode because... They're just not that action-packed or detail-packed, but they're worth talking about.
Okay. Well, we got six of them. Let's start with the first one.
Sounds good.
Prepare your noggin for story number one.
We're going to start with a young lady named Autumn Lane McClure. Autumn was a 16-year-old girl living with her grandmother in Ormond Beach, Florida. She was studying at Mainland High School at the time. On May 10th, 2004, Autumn's grandmother called the sheriff's office to report her missing after she didn't return home that day. Autumn was last seen with her boyfriend. Police questioned her boyfriend, who told them that he had dropped Autumn off at the Fallujah Mall and had not seen her since then. A search was launched for the missing teenager, but nothing turned up. Sometime afterward, Autumn's grandmother told detectives that Autumn called her from a different area code, and that she had received some letters from Autumn, postmarked from Melbourne, Florida, claiming she was okay and would return home after she turned 18. This case went quiet until 2004 when the detectives received information that Autumn was staying at a house with two people, Brian Donnelly and Jessica Freeman. When detectives went to the couple's home, they said Autumn had stayed with them for a few days and then just left.
Okay.
They said that they were co-workers of Autumn's at a Winn-Dixie supermarket. They told detectives that Autumn didn't get along with her grandmother, and they'd been letting her stay at their trailer for a couple days, but didn't really know anything else. The case then went cold, but detectives continued to work the case, obtaining DNA from family members and entering it in a national database of missing children. The case remained cold until 12 years later when detectives again contacted the boyfriend. This time, her boyfriend claimed that he had lied to them about dropping Autumn off at the Fallujah Mall. He said he had actually dropped her off at the Seabreeze Bridge, where she then got into a car with Jessica Freeman.
Dropped her off at a bridge?
Yep.
That's a weird thing to do. Just dropped her off in the water.
Just took her to the bridge.
Just hanging out at the bridge. We like to do roller skating on the bridge. I don't know what the fuck's going on.
Well, detectives tracked down Freeman, who was now living in Nevada, and she claimed she didn't know anything about Autumn's disappearance. In 2021, detectives caught a break when a tipster told police that Freeman and Donnelly were involved in Autumn's disappearance. The police questioned Freeman again, who this time ask for immunity in exchange for her answering questions about Autumn's disappearance. Freeman told detectives that she worked with Autumn, and she and Donnelly allowed her to stay with them at the trailer. Same story as before. Freeman said she was also in a sexual relationship with the couple. That's where things changed. Freeman told investigators that one day, she returned home to see Donnelly allegedly choking Autumn in the bathroom. She was unable to save Autumn's life, and she left the trailer where the three had lived. When she returned 2 weeks later and inquired about what had happened to Autumn, Donnelly allegedly told her, quote, "Shut up or the same thing's going to happen to you," end quote.
Nice folk.
Over the years, Donnelly allegedly told Freeman several times about how he had, quote, "cut Autumn up and buried her and spread her parts over different parts of the county," she said.
Nice folk.
Eek. She said she didn't know where Donnelly had actually buried the body, though. In late 2023, Freeman told authorities that she believes Autumn's body was buried beneath the trailer, as Donnelly had allegedly expressed satisfaction at the fact that a new concrete slab had been placed on that site.
I'm living on top of that bitch.
Right. Using ground-penetrating radar, authorities searched the surface. They found spots of different density around the surrounding soil. Subsequently, authorities worked with the new owner of the trailer on the property to excavate the remains. In February 2024, authorities recover what they say is 99.9% of Autumn's remains, which were taken to the medical examiner to confirm her identification. Despite her remains being found, Donnelly could not be charged as he died in 2022. That's our first story.
All right. So what stood out for you in this story?
I found this one interesting, mainly because it is a cold case that was solved very recently. But I find it interesting that so many murderers, so many people
want to live on top of the people that they killed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's fascinating to me.
So much about control and power.
It really, really is. The simple fact that they...
Pettiness.
So there's so many of the stories that are like that.
Yeah.
Not in this episode, but so many of these crime stories that I listen to, the bodies are right there.
I wonder if aliens came and wiped us out and then picked up each house and looked under it. What percentage?
Like a rock.
Homes? Yeah.
Like what? Lifting up a rock to find bugs.
Yeah. I wonder what percentage would be like, oh, there's a dead one under there. Well, they like to just keep those dead bodies in there. That's
they
weird.
They just like living on top of them. It's very strange.
All right. Let's do the next story.
Okay.
And just like that, we're on to story number two.
This next story is about Linda Sue Childers. In May 1974, Connecticut State Police received a tip about two murders that had occurred at a home on Shoeville Road, Ledyard, Connecticut.
We live in Shoeville.
Shoeville.
That sounds good.
Right there next to Sauktown in the Undergarment District.
Investigators searched the house and the surrounding area. They soon found decomposed bodies of a man and a woman in two shallow graves several hundred feet behind the house. The man would later be identified as convicted serial bank robber Gustavus Lee Carmichael, who actually had escaped from custody.
Oh, shit.
He had committed multiple bank robberies across the nation, and in 1970, he was apprehended for the theft of $60,000 from a bank in New Jersey. Additionally, throughout his lifetime, he had faced convictions for various offenses, such as burglary, kidnapping, attempted burglary, grand larceny, assault and battery, and armed robbery.
He wanted other people's shit desperately.
He was, somebody who didn't like to follow the rules.
Mm-hmm.
However, in October 1970, during his transfer from a Massachusetts jail to federal court in Hartford, Connecticut, he and another inmate managed to escape custody, prompting the FBI to issue a federal warrant for his arrest. Now, while on the run, he met a woman, and they began to go by the names Dirk and Lorraine Stahl.
And Honey Bunny and Schnookumpuff.
They were staying at the home of Richard DeFreitas and Donald Brandt, fellow bank robbers. DeFreitas and Brandt possessed several safe houses, utilizing, they used that to harbor fugitives evading law enforcement.
That's your business model?
Right?
We like to work with criminals,
we're
basically.
We're helping people.
Yeah, we got a punch card system.
Nonetheless, the woman, Lorraine Stahl, confided in DeFreitas' wife that she was afraid of the lifestyle that they were leading.
Oh, yeah.
When DeFreitas learned about her fears, he told Brand, and they decided to eliminate Carmichael and the woman, fearing that her potential capture could lead to exposure of their illicit operations. Giving the perceived difficulty of eliminating the woman without Carmichael's likely intervention, they opted to murder Carmichael as well.
Might as well.
Investigators believed Carmichael and the woman were killed on December 31st, 1970, 4 years earlier. DeFreitas and Brandt fatally shot Carmichael and the woman and then dumped their bodies, which remained undiscovered for more than 3 years. Richard DeFreitas and Donald Brandt were eventually convicted of the murders and have since died. Even though the man was identified, the woman was never identified, as she had used an alias, and that was never verified. Before going by the name Lorraine Stahl, she was known to use the names Connie and Sandy, and was known to drive around in a 1964 green Oldsmobile with either Massachusetts or Maine plates.
Remember those big Oldsmobiles? My grandpa had a couple of those.
Big, giant cars.
Just like, what the fuck, dude? This looks like you're driving a calculator. It's driving a desk calculator is what you're doing. You remember those old calculators? They looked like they were matching set.
Oh, my gosh. Well, the car was eventually found dumped in Hartford with a Maine inspection sticker on the license plate.
Mm-hmm.
She was known to have possibly worked in New York City. Now, after the bodies were discovered, police found clothes and jewelry with the woman's remains, including a tan leather wet look vest. I don't know what the wet look is.
I know what that is for your hair.
A gold or tan sweater, brown tweed skirt, and a pair of brown granny boots. She was also
granny boots. Are those like moon boots, but for grannies?
She was also wearing a pendant and rings, according to state police. A class ring had the letters JHSN monogrammed, the initials ILN, and the date 1917
Illen.
Engraved inside. 1917.
In 1970, she was Illen.
Right. Well, Lorraine Stahl would go unidentified for 50 years. Her case profile was entered into National Missing and Unidentified Person System in 2011 and CODIS in 2012, but she remained unidentified. Then, in 2022, DNA samples were sent to Othron Labs, who were able to build a DNA profile of this victim. In January 2024, the results helped to find a connection with the victim's sister. They also found out that the victim had a daughter who provided DNA samples, and soon the Lorraine Stahl was identified as Linda Sue Childers. Now, Childers was born September 4th, 1946, and was originally from Louisville, Kentucky. Her sister and daughter were notified of her identification. So this case was solved after more than 50 years.
Fucking A.
Blows my mind.
Is that what stood out the most to you? Why you picked this one?
This one was another one of those Othram DNA profiles through families that they're just cleaning house at this point.
That's what it feels like. They're going through history and they're like, we can solve all these.
Yep.
Let's solve them all, finally.
The other thing that stood out was the simple fact that there was a whole band of bank robbers.
Yeah.
It was interesting. You're a bank robber. And they all kind of live together and travel together and there's safe houses and shit. It just sounds very, I don't know.
Can you imagine the meeting that they had at the beginning when they're like, well, I see that you like taking people's stuff by force. And I like it. They're at a bar. They're like,
We should team up.
And I know another guy who's a prick.
We should hang out.
It kind of reminds me of our last episode where the secret society of fucking Radio Shack nerds that are trying to summon aliens. It's like there's a lot of different groups out there.
Right.
That just kind of rally around certain things that are different.
Yeah, well, this group here, you know, clustered because they like to steal things.
Well, I'm going to take that guy's stuff.
Yeah.
Me too.
Well, right.
Let's make a team. We're a family of stealers. Good. Team Steal.
Now it's time for the next story. Prepare yourself accordingly.
All right, so our next story is about Kelly Ann Workman.
Okay.
Kelly was a 24-year-old woman living with her parents in Douglas County, Missouri. Her parents described her as a quiet, independent, and hardworking woman. Her parents were dairy farmers, and Kelly helped them on the farm, but she also provided lawn care and maintenance services, often completed house and yard work for people in the Dogwood area. On June 30th, 1989, Kelly was mowing the grass at Dogwood Cemetery, adjoining the Pleasant Southern Baptist Church. Kelly was meticulous about her work, clipping along the rows of headstones before using trimmers to cut the stray blades from around each grave marker. She started working around 3:30 p.m. Now, at around 5 p.m., it started raining, and Kelly went home to feed the calves while her parents milked the cows at their rented Seymour farm. When the rain stopped at 5:40, Kelly was back at the cemetery. Her uncle actually saw her mowing as he drove by. This was the last time Kelly was seen alive.
Right.
20 minutes later, with less than half the job completed, it appears that Kelly just left the mower besides a tombstone and just left the cemetery.
Ominous. Oh, it was a cemetery, so yeah.
Right. Well, when she failed to return home for dinner later that night, her parents became worried and reported her missing to the police. However, police told her parents to wait, as they suggested she may have just run away.
They say that every time.
Yep.
But it is probably likely,
you know,
the way it is every time.
I'm thinking that if you take a look at these alleged missing person cases that are called in as a disappearance or kidnapping or whatever it might be, I wonder what the ratio actually is of people who, you know, sorry, I was stuck in traffic and I'm getting home late, or I just decided to go on a date, you know?
Right.
I wonder how many are actually that way, because so many of these cases, we do talk about that, where the police is like, well, just wait.
Right.
They probably just took off.
But they must see this all the time. Where
they
like,
must.
Yeah, they ran away. They'll be back. I wonder what the numbers are.
Well, that would be interesting to find out. I'm not sure where I'd find that, but
people
I would be interested.
People probably panic first.
Guaranteed.
Because most of the time that doesn't happen, and then they take leaps of, oh God, it could be this.
Right.
And it's like, no, he's just at the baseball game or whatever.
Well, it's to be expected, really. I mean, her parents disagreed with the police because Kelly was extremely dependable.
Right.
And that's why.
Right.
They
it's like,
called.
This is so out of the ordinary. Just
right.
help us.
Well, they say she would not have left her work unfinished, which, you know, was alarming. Her parents and friends organized their own searches, and soon, despite suggesting Kelly ran away, the police launched a wide search for her in and around Douglas County. Kelly's 1986 Oldsmobile was found in the church parking lot with its keys still in the ignition. For several days, the search involved hundreds of volunteers, sniffer dogs, and police helicopters scouring the countryside. However, nothing would be found. Then, 7 days later, on the 7th of July, a farmer and his son in nearby Christian County stumbled upon Kelly's remains submerged in water from the waist down. Her body, she was actually like sitting in water.
Weird.
Yeah. Her body was found about 10 miles from where she had disappeared. Her body was fully clothed, but so badly decomposed that it actually took dental records to identify her.
Oh, that would be spooky to come across that.
Mm-hmm.
Fucking, what is that sticking out of the wall?
Well, how she died remains murky. Her death certificate lists homicidal violence. Now, authorities believe that Kelly was abducted from the cemetery with a motive of sexual assault. However, at the time, the autopsy stated she was not sexually assaulted. It was only recently that the investigators confirmed that Kelly was indeed assaulted.
Wow.
She probably died in the early hours of July 1st. However, due to the state of decomposition, they could not determine the time of death as well as the cause of death. Kelly's mother, Joan Workman, believes she knows the exact moment that Kelly died. She said that after reporting her missing on the 1st of July at 3:30 a.m., as she sat on the living room couch and worried about Kelly with family and friends, she felt a surge of panic and pain in her chest. She thought to herself, quote, hang on, Kelly, hang on, we're on our way. But then the feeling passed, and Joan was left feeling dead inside.
Oh, man.
Kelly's body was interred at the Dogwood Cemetery, and her parents harbored frustration towards the Douglas County Sheriff's Department, feeling that had the police treated the case with the gravity it deserved from the outset, there might have been a chance to save Kelly. Their anger stemmed from the failure of the police to
do police things.
Dust Kelly's 1986 Oldsmobile Cutlass for fingerprints.
The calculator with wheels.
Additionally, they expressed disappointment that crucial pieces of information, such as reports of a screaming woman, were overlooked amid the chaos of the initial night.
Hmm.
A few months later, Kelly's mother learned that 4 days after Kelly's abduction, an anonymous caller reached out to her home, leaving a message with another family member regarding a sighting of someone at the Workman residence on the afternoon of the abduction. Surprisingly, this caller did not reach out to any law enforcement agencies involved in the investigation, though. Joan believes that her daughter might have known her abductor or assailant. A reward of $10,000 was offered for any information. Police questioned several suspects over the years, but none were ever charged. There were two suspects who were repeatedly questioned in Kelly's murder. Dwight and Bobby Banks were two brothers who had been pulled over by a Missouri Highway Patrol officer in 1990 as they were traveling down the highway in a pickup truck on the night of Kelly's disappearance.
All right.
Now, it's unclear why they were suspected in Kelly's murder, but Dwight Banks was asked by police to take a polygraph test regarding Kelly Workman's murder, which he agreed to take. He reportedly passed the test. A few years later, Dwight and his brother Bobby again became a suspect after Dwight reportedly confessed to several people to murdering Kelly.
Oh.
In a 1995 article from the Springfield News Leader, it was reported that Dwight had confessed multiple times to killing Kelly.
They called their paper the News Leader?
The News Leader, right?
Dude, back to the drawing board on that one. No.
However, he later asserted that these confessions were just made in jest, kind of a attention-grabbing, attributing them to being under the influence of alcohol at the time.
Hmm.
I could not imagine admitting to murdering somebody because I was drinking.
I've never had a moment where I'm like, no, yeah, I'm that's fucking a good drunk. Idea. You know, bro,
you
I
know
love
what?
You a lot. I killed fuck JFK, bro.
Right, oh. Right. I could not imagine, you know. So Dwight admitted that he and Bobby saw Kelly just a few hours before she was abducted, where she was working at the cemetery. But he said he didn't kill her, right?
Mm-hmm.
Dwight Banks added that his brother Bobby was also innocent. He said, my brother's innocent.
That's cut and dry.
Right. Well, at the time, well, the case solved, right?
Yeah.
At the time of Kelly's disappearance, Dwight Banks told the News Leader that he and Bobby were at his house eating fried chicken. However, the News Leader also reported that authorities have been told that Dwight Banks may have taken drugs before the 1990 polygraph examination, which he passed.
What kind of street drugs help you pass a lie detector test?
I don't fucking know.
That seems like information that people should have been.
I dug around. I couldn't find what drugs they were. Hmm. I don't know. I guess he got high. And they're saying that it helped him pass the test.
Huh. All right. Well,
later, Dwight's brother Bobby had an ex-girlfriend to provide an alibi for him for the evening Kelly went missing, which she reported to the police. So the News Leader reported that Bobby Banks failed the
polygraph. News Leader, your News Leader for news leading. Goddamn.
Well, the News Leader reported that Bobby Banks failed the polygraph test, which Dwight Banks attributed to his brother's, quote, frail emotions.
And not doing drugs. He needed the mushrooms that helped
him. He was overly sensitive, I guess. Well, 9 years later, the Missouri Highway Patrol Crime Lab issued a warrant for two men, one of which was Dwight, seeking DNA evidence allegedly connecting him to the killing. But the test did not yield conclusive findings. On February 20th, 2024, the authorities said at a news conference that three men had been arrested and indicted on charges of first-degree murder, forcible rape, and first-degree kidnapping. The men were identified as Wiley Belt and the initial suspects' brothers, Dwight Banks and Bobby Banks. Investigators say the case was cracked wide open by an eyewitness, someone in the community who actually came forward, giving them the evidence needed to take this case to a grand jury. All three men are now in their mid-60s at the time of the arrest. Currently, the Banks brothers and Belt are being held at the Douglas County Jail in Ava, where each is held on a $250,000 cash bond.
Fucking A. Well, what stands out for this story for you?
This one was the mother's, this one mainly was the mother's reaction. She knew exactly when her daughter passed.
Yeah.
And the simple fact that it, you know, they kind of knew who the people were. The police knew who did it very early on.
And it just took forever.
And it took forever. Yeah.
And also news leader.
I know.
Fucking dudes. Like that passed the whole, like there was a committee. They're like, oh, news leader. We're the leaders in news. It's like, we're just starting.
We're just for the leader.
Just take that hubris and run, bro. All right. On to the next story.
And now for something completely different, but similar. So similar. Yeah.
This next story is the story of Terry Becker. On December 6th, 1975, a chilling discovery sent shockwaves through a small, quiet town. Two citizens, innocently riding their motorcycles, stumbled upon a lifeless body in a field at the eerie intersection of 100th Avenue and Lowell Boulevard. Little did they know, this grim find marked the beginning of an unsolved mystery that would haunt the community for nearly half a century. The woman was identified as Terry Becker. Becker grew up in Casper with her parents, a brother, and a sister. She was a graduate of Kelly Walsh High School and worked for the newspaper for a short period of time.
She better not be called the news leader, motherfuckers.
Well, she moved to Denver shortly after graduating. Her family said that she had often lived life on the edge, kind of a thrill seeker. They said she never met a stranger and would hold a conversation with just about anyone. Terry enjoyed painting and listening to music. On December 4th, 1975, Terry was last seen alive while hitchhiking in Brighton, Colorado, intending to visit her boyfriend, who was incarcerated at the Adams County Jail at the time. After reportedly hitchhiking to the detention center, her exact whereabouts remain unknown after that. Her body was found 2 days later. It appeared that Terry's body had been dumped in the field along with her clothing and some personal items. An autopsy revealed that she had been sexually assaulted and strangled to death. Despite multiple investigations and reviews, the case remained unsolved until 2003, when a DNA sample of an unknown male was pulled from the evidence found at the crime scene. The DNA profile was entered into CODIS, however, no matches were found. In 2013, Las Vegas Metro Police Department was reviewing a 1991 murder case of Sherry Bridgewater, who was found raped and murdered in her apartment. They submitted the DNA found at the crime scene to CODIS, and to their surprise, it matched the unknown suspect in Terry Becker's murder.
Fucking hey, bro.
It was determined the suspect who murdered Terry Becker also murdered Sherry Bridgewater in Las Vegas.
CODIS for the win?
Right.
What the fuck?
However, they did not know the suspect's identity at that time. In 2018, the case was submitted for genetic genealogy testing to identify a match.
CODIS will find you.
Through hereditary DNA analysis. After 5 years of research and testing, Thomas Martin Elliott was identified as a suspect in both murders.
Gotcha, bitch.
In October of 2023, his body was exhumed and then was positively identified as the killer in both cases in January 2024. Elliot had a lengthy criminal record and spent significant time in and out of prisons.
But he died free, it sounds. I guess he went to a lot of prisons, but he died not being caught for that those crimes.
For this crime, yeah. Well, he committed a burglary in Lakewood before murdering Terry. And he would ultimately be convicted and serve 6 years in prison for that burglary.
But he was killing people, bro.
Right, they
he
didn't
be
know.
In a whole
but
different
he,
wing.
He killed someone, stole, and then went to prison for stealing. So while in prison, Elliot had moved throughout the Department of Correction system and was ultimately released from prison in Las Vegas in 1981.
Wait a minute, wait a minute. I had a thought.
Mm-hmm.
So if this is a simulation,
mm-hmm.
and there's a lot of people that are just good people. That,
right.
They're never going to kill or steal. They're good folk. But I wonder if it's just like video games where you can kind of choose to be evil.
Oh, God.
On the other end. Like, before you come here, you're like, I'm going to just fuck shit up. Like Fallout 4. It's like, would you like to befriend the bartender? No, I'm killing him.
I'm
taking all his stuff.
Him, right.
And that's what these people are. And that's why it makes no sense. We're like, but that's wrong. And they're like, no, I didn't come here for that.
I didn't come here for that.
I came here to fuck shit up. Right. Sorry, just a thought.
Kick ass and chew bubblegum.
Yeah, I'm all out of bubblegum.
Yep. So after his release, he proceeded to commit a crime against a child and received a 10-year sentence.
Well, fuck that guy.
Well, he
was... Don't pick that option.
He was again released in Las Vegas in 1991, where he would go on to murder Sherry Bridgewater. Thomas Elliott committed suicide on October 30th, 1991.
And we were all jamming to grunge music right then.
Well, authorities are currently retracing the DNA data to determine if additional cases may be linked to Thomas Elliott.
Hmm. All right. Well, fucking A. That's a weird story.
That was, isn't it?
Yeah.
Convoluted, strange. Yeah.
And what drew you to this one besides the convolution and strangeness?
This one here is just another one of those where you can't hide. Mm. You just can't hide. And
dude, CODIS, bro.
Right?
CODIS?
CODIS, C-O-D-I-S, the combined...
Is this a robot or something? Is this the AI machine that we should be worried about? Like, fuck Skynet?
It's a database. It's the combined DNA...
It's coming for you.
Yeah.
If you fucking picked your nose and put it under a chair at fucking school in 1992, you're fucking, they're finding you.
Well, if you ever, all felons have to submit a DNA sample, from what I understand.
Right.
At a certain degree.
So CODIS knows only the evil world.
Only the bad stuff.
So if CODIS comes alive, he's like, all you fuckers gotta go. All y'all.
Right.
Interesting.
Well, and like the fingerprints, that database is ridiculously massive.
Yeah, I bet.
Especially when you started giving your finger your thumbprint for IDs, for driver's licenses. Where you actually have to give a thumbprint.
Imagine the people, the companies that are involved in the in CODIS and these fingerprint companies. They're privy to some really interesting information and actually are trusted with a lot of power, I would say.
Well, there's actually several stories that I have been tracking that they've used the most interesting methods to solve these crimes. There's so many databases and the technology that we have nowadays. I mean...
They just open up a suitcase and there's a little robot. I am CODIS. Right. I'm coming for you, bitch.
It's just technology has advanced so much that you can't hide shit.
We've talked about this in the past.
Yeah.
It's like,
it's amazing to me.
Without government, although it's police and stuff that are doing it, but it's a technology. It's going to make it so people are going to be disincentivized from committing crimes.
I would hope so.
They're going to find me no matter what.
I would hope so.
Yeah.
You would think. I mean, but we just had a story, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago, Catherine Hayes, where they stopped drawing and quartering people in the 1700s because it just wasn't enough incentive to not commit crimes. Well, we're not going to pull their arms off and disembowel them. It's just not working.
It's not working. We could just yell at them, and it's about the same. It doesn't matter.
So we're just going to put them on a boat and send them away.
I think it might be more about us wanting to rip people apart than them. You know, I don't know. Might be an us thing.
Well, are you ready for the next story?
I am.
Okay.
How about another story?
Yeah. All right. This next story is about two women. Teresa Pica and Nellie Hicks.
Must be the money.
Nellie Hicks was a 59-year-old woman who lived with a housemate in Newark, California.
Nellie Hicks, huh?
Mm. Oh my gosh.
Must be the money. All right, sorry.
She had divorced her husband a decade ago and raised her family of six on her own. She worked as a fourth grade teacher at Ashland High School in San Lorenzo. On May 10th, 1972, Nellie's housemate spoke with Nellie around 1 a.m. before returning to her bedroom. Nellie dozed off on the living room sofa. It was the last time she would ever be seen alive. 4 hours later, one of Nellie's sons woke up to find an absolutely horrifying scene. Nellie's bloodied, lifeless body laying on the sofa.
Thanks.
He immediately notified the police. Nellie had been found partially naked and bludgeoned to death by a brick wrapped in pantyhose.
Yikes.
The brutality was immediately apparent, with her head split open by force of the blows.
Yikes, dude.
She had also been sexually assaulted.
Fucking bro.
Right. Well, police determined the killer entered the house through an unlocked sliding glass door and used manicure scissors to cut her dress and bra. Police believe the killer had knocked Nellie unconscious before sexually assaulting her, as one of her sons and his wife, as well as her housemates, were asleep as the slaying took place.
The problem with this guy is that he was set on evil.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, Nellie's wallet was missing.
Is this me being insensitive? Sorry. This must be the money. I'm sorry. I will stop doing that, probably. No, maybe not.
Oh, my God.
One more time. Oh. What year was this? It was a good year. 14 years ago, some shit.
Uh-huh.
All right, sorry. Please continue.
However, her wallet was later found a few blocks away next to a pair of blood-stained underwear.
Yikes, I am very insensitive. This sucks.
The only forensic evidence that police recorded were fingerprints that, for decades, were never tied to a specific person. Police interrogated her housemate, her entire family, her ex-husband, and the man she had dated. However, no one was ever charged. The case remained unsolved for more than half a century. In 1979, another murder occurred with the same modus operandi. Teresa Pica was a 48-year-old woman who lived with her children in Hayward, California. On May 15, 1979, Teresa's 10-year-old twin daughter woke up in their Eldo Drive home to find her mother slumped over the couch, face down. Her nightgown had been pulled up, exposing her legs. Her hands were bound behind her back with rope, and a blood-stained rock was discovered nearby.
God damn.
A shirt had been utilized to gag her, and it was observed that a front room window had been forcibly opened. A neighbor later reported hearing rustling near the home during the night. Pica's purse was missing, and her wallet, along with other belongings, were subsequently found in a neighbor's yard and in a garbage can down the street. Just like in Nellie's case, Teresa was sexually assaulted and murdered while three of her daughters were asleep in the house. Nobody woke up during these assaults. Over the years, a number of people would be investigated in the cases, but none were ever charged. Following Pica's murder, the Newark and Hayward police departments connected the crimes due to the identifiable pattern of behavior common to both cases. This led to the belief that solving one case would solve the other. Evidence was collected at both crime scenes. However, DNA testing did not exist at that time. In the early 2000s, based on the DNA found at the crime scenes, a male DNA profile was developed and then entered into CODIS.
Fucking here he comes.
Right? Well, however, no matches were found at that time. In 2021, the Hayward Police Department submitted forensic evidence to Othram in the Woodlands, Texas. Now, Othram scientists successfully used forensic-grade genome sequencing to build a comprehensive DNA profile for the unidentified suspect. And in February of 2024, Fred Bernard Farnham was identified as a suspect in both cases. Farnham had a lengthy criminal record. He grew up in the Central Valley and then moved to the South Bay in the 1950s. He served prison time after he was convicted of several sexual assaults in Sunnyvale and San Jose in the 1970s.
Fuck.
He also lived in Nevada, Idaho, South Dakota, Alaska, and Oregon. Farnham died at the age of 73 in a hospital in 2007 before detectives were able to link him to the killings.
Another one that got away without
help. Yeah. Well, police believe Farnham could be responsible for many other unsolved murders. The cases, these two, fortunately, were solved after more than half a century. But they're holding out, thinking that he may have been involved in many others.
Fuck. I wonder how many serial killers have just gotten away with it.
Murder in general. I wonder how many.
It's got to be a high percentage.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're on the trail, so we'll celebrate. All right, let's go on to the next story, shall we?
Oh, my gosh.
And now it's time for another...
All right, so now for the story of Mary Jane Van Gilder. Mary Jane Croft Van Gilder was born on November 19th, 1911 in Fairmont, West Virginia. She married James Wesley Van Gilder on January 29th, 1929. By the time World War II broke out, Mary had given birth to her fifth child after their twins were stillborn in 1935. Hmm. But her marriage to James was troubled, and in 1943, Mary moved to the Van Gilder family farm. Now, it's unclear why James and Mary separated, but sources say Mary alleged her husband was alcoholic and abusive, although her children said they don't believe their father was abusive at all. In 1944, Mary moved to Plymouth, Ohio, and got a job as a forklift operator at the Wilkins Air Force Depot in Shelby.
Fucking A.
Right? Well, Mary didn't own a vehicle. She got rides to and from work from coworkers.
She got enough vehicle with that forklift.
Right,
you know, just
right,
more
right.
than enough.
So after moving to Ohio, Mary maintained contact with her children, mailing war bonds as well as letters and occasionally clothing. Well, her children have no idea why she moved away and even why she separated from her husband. I mean, they were very confused. Mary's oldest daughter, Anna Mae Van Gilder Rager, said, quote, "In 1945, my mother sued my dad for divorce, which made me think she was wanting to get married again, but we found no answer to that question," end quote. In 1945, Mary Jane sent a letter to West Virginia asking her children to send the war bonds back to her in Plymouth. A few weeks later, she sent them her final war bond. Very strange.
Yeah.
It was the last time her family ever heard from Mary Jane. James filed for a divorce a few months later, but Mary never responded. When she failed to show up to court, Mary's divorce petition was withdrawn by her attorney in April 1946. James was granted the divorce and full custody of the children by a judge in West Virginia. Now, by 1949, Mary's oldest daughter, Anna, started looking for her mother. And it wasn't until May 5th, 1952, that she would learn that her mother had left her employment at the Wilkins Air Force Depot on March 8th, 1945, stating she needed to leave because of, quote, "added household duties," end quote. Although she was never officially reported missing, her daughter, Anna, kept looking for her mother. Now, in 2004, Anna found a new link to her mother's past after a newspaper in Ohio wrote a story about their search for Van Gilder. A man read the Plymouth Journal article and emailed Anna that his father had worked with Mary between 1943 and 1945, but they didn't know what happened to her after that. In April 2018, Anna's daughter, Mary's granddaughter, finally reported Mary missing to the police. It took until 2018 for a missing persons report. That's insane.
Yeah.
The investigating officer, Adam Turner, said that pain, that desperation, and that need to know is still very fresh for Anna. The not knowing is worse than the knowing. When somebody's missing, you're left in limbo, end quote. Adam began working on the case and obtained Mary's military personnel file and published it online to see if it would help generate some leads. Soon, a civilian sleuth pointed him to a name on a document in the file that would prove crucial to solving the case. The sleuth came across the name Percy L. Sebrin. It turned out when Mary was promoted to high lift fork operator,
moving on up.
Well, she took the position from Sebrin and likely received training from him. Searching Sebrin's history on findagrave.com, Adam learned the man died in Kansas City, Missouri in 1969. It also showed he was married to a Mary Jane Sebrin, who was born on November 19, 1911, and died in 1990. Both were buried in Forest, Louisiana. Sebrin was run over and killed by a train. The couple lived in Arkansas and had two children. Now, interestingly, the first child was born in December 1945, just 9 months after Van Gilder left her job at the Wilkins Air Force Depot.
Interesting.
Adam then reached out to one of Sebrin's grandchildren, who promptly supplied him with photographs of Mary Jane Sebring. Additionally, he obtained a document containing Mary Jane Sebring's signature from the grandchildren. A comparison of this signature with that of Mary Jane Van Gilder revealed distinct similarities in letter shapes and formatting. The photos indicated a striking resemblance between Mary Jane Sebring and Mary Jane Van Gilder.
Dun, dun, dun.
In February 2024, a DNA test conclusively confirmed the identity of Mary Jane Sebring as Mary Jane Van Gilder.
Fucking A.
According to the grandchildren from her second family, Mary Jane was an exceptional grandmother, passionate about gardening with a fondness for hydrangeas.
I fucking love this plant. Love your plant. Grow.
She enjoyed sun tea and excelled in the culinary arts.
She loved fresca.
Yep. and finger foods.
And yeah, I like eating stuff.
Surprisingly, Mary was discovered to be using a different social security number than the one documented in her military file. Mary died from colon cancer in 1990. She was cremated and buried next to her husband. During her final moments, Mary Jane confided to one of her granddaughters, hinting at a secret she could never reveal. Hmm. Her granddaughter said that she, quote, just assumed that her grandmother was just talking gibberish, but now it all makes sense.
Hmm.
Adam expressed how discovering the truth about Mary Jane's fate had been an agonizing experience for the Van Gilder family, who spent decades searching for her. The case of Mary Jane would unearth two more mysteries, though. During the search for Mary Jane, the officer, Adam Turner, found a record for a Jane Doe found in Preble County in 1960s. Jane Doe's description resembled that of Mary Jane Van Gilder, prompting the exhumation of remains in late 2019 for DNA testing. However, the results did not match Mary Jane. But the detective decided to press on and find the identity of Jane Doe. He partnered with Moxie Forensic Investigations to develop a DNA profile and use genetic genealogy to crack the case. Surprisingly, the Preble County Jane Doe turned out to be Albert Frost, a man from Hamilton, Ohio, missing since the early 1960s. Albert's body had been severely decomposed, spread out over about 75 feet, which may lead to the mistake. His cause of death is not determined. Now, upon contacting Albert's closest DNA relative, his great-niece Tina Barrett, another mystery unfolded. Tina initially thought they were referring to her great-aunt Clara, unaware of Albert's existence. So it turned out there were two missing siblings in the same family. Albert had a sister named Clara who also disappeared and was never seen again. She was in her early 20s when she went missing about a decade after Albert in the 1950s. Family members disclosed that Clara's mother had sold her to a man who later became her husband. They had two kids together, who were just a baby and a toddler when she vanished. Clara's family thought her disappearance was suspicious and told police that her husband had been physically abusive to her. Clara's husband denied anything to do with her disappearance and claimed she just ran off.
R-U-N-N-O-F-T? Remember that movie?
Mm-hmm. Well, the husband remarried and then moved to Pennsylvania. Clara's husband, now deceased, even today, remains a suspect in her disappearance.
Right.
And that's the end of that story.
Fucking A.
Isn't that, talk about a rabbit hole this guy went on.
Yeah.
Insane.
Is that what attracted?
This one was very interesting because of the rabbit hole feel to it.
Huh.
And the fact that she lived a double life.
Yeah, that is crazy.
I mean, she had two lives.
It gives you inspiration, although today it makes it difficult with Facebook and cameras everywhere to live. Like, say, you know what? I fucked up that half of my life. I'm just going to go do another
one. We're starting over. We got a mulligan on this. So the woman went missing,
mm-hmm.
And they presumed that she was dead.
Mm-hmm.
And then they found after she had died that she just left and married someone else.
Mm-hmm.
But then in the process of trying to, piece it all together, DNA because the police officers had a you know, an idea. He's like, you know what? I know that's what this whole story is turning out to be, but there's this one Jane Doe that just fits this case. So then he goes back and tests the DNA against that Jane Doe, but it doesn't match. But then he ends up finding out it's a man and then finds out the man's sister also disappeared. So it's just, I mean, it just blows me away.
Sure does.
How it just rabbit holes.
Well, that's the last story of the day. Let's talk about our little conclusions on the other side of the conclusion thing.
Okie dokie.
Okay.
And now for the final.
All right. Well, thank you for sharing all those stories with us and
you're
finding
welcome.
All that shit. And
you're
we have two more in the bonus area, too.
Yes, we do.
So for patrons, if you want to keep listening to some stories that have these weird little twists and CODIS fucking coming to the day, save the day.
Othram.
Yeah.
Yep.
And if you want to have some more coffee with us, because that's what we're doing this morning.
Yep.
Yep. But thank you for everything on this one.
You're welcome. Thank you for listening.
Yeah. Thank you guys for listening. Thank you to our trusted turd triad, our trusted turd herders, mm-hmm. our trusted meme army. Mm-hmm. Everyone's trusted now.
I know. They're all trusted.
I'm throwing a lot of trust your way because you guys have earned it for sure.
Yes.
We appreciate all of our Reddit people, mm-hmm. The Reddit regulation group.
Yes.
PJ and Minibug. We love you guys, and we appreciate all the meetups we've seen.
Mm-hmm.
It's been cool to see people gathering in real life.
Oh, it's heartwarming.
It really is. There's a couple of holidays that we'll be definitely commemorating that.
Mm-hmm.
You can find those holidays in the back of a couple of the Scat Card Battle Scat cards.
Nice.
You can get the Battle Scat Metal Collector's card. It's mm-hmm. basically a challenge coin, but it's in the card form.
Mm-hmm.
You can get that by itself, $39.99. You can get your name on it. Or you can get this collection that we put together. It's got some crazy shit in it. For $79.99, you mm-hmm. get the card, too. You also get your name listed on the back of one of the cards in that full set for this year.
Mm-hmm.
It's really cool. It's one of my favorite merch items that I've ever...
It's exciting.
Yes. All right, bonus stuff if you want to continue with us.
Mm-hmm.
But as always, we'll talk at you in the future.
And it'll seem like the present.
Bye.
Bye.
Dipshit file. Bing.
Bong.
Bing bong.